I'm Andrew Finney, and welcome to Series 4 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at being able to sort of dig deep into the lives of nurse researchers at all levels. This new series will be the PhD student series, and we're really looking forward to being able to hear back from and listen to people that have just completed a PhD or are currently undertaking a PhD. So listen in and enjoy. Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and a real special guest for me today. We're on our PhD student series, and I'd like to welcome Sandra Dyer. So Sandra, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, welcome Andrew, it's great to be here.
And I've stopped giving people their titles and roles and names of what they do, Sandra, because I can never remember it all. So you tell us what your current title is.
I'm a PhD student at King's College London, rather, within the Cicely Saunders Institute, which is Department of Palliative Care.
And do you still class yourself as Sandra Dyer, Advanced Nurse Practitioner as well?
Not working clinically at the moment, so I still class myself as a registered nurse and primary care nurse, but I'm not currently working as an advanced nurse practitioner.
So it's the PhD series. We're going to get to hear about your PhD. It's a bittersweet episode for me to some extent, because I wanted to be working with you on your PhD, but we didn't quite get there. We'll get there with a story, but I know you've probably listened to previous episodes of this and you know what the podcast is about. The episode's about you, so we always start with, tell us how and why you became a nurse.
Yeah, I was thinking about this question before I came on, because I've listened to a few of these now. So I think my primary kind of motivation when I was much younger was I had a road traffic accident and I had a fractured femur from being hit by a car. And I spent about 6 or 7 weeks in King's College Hospital when I was 16, and I was on an adult female orthopaedic ward, and it was quite a traumatic experience in lots of ways. So I was just surrounded by lots of older people with obviously quite frail, with injuries, fractures, often with dementia and delirium, and often quite distressed people, and quite high rates of people dying around me, which I've obviously never experienced as a 16-year-old growing up in the UK. I think the really thing that really stood out for me was the kind of role of the nurses in terms of kind of taking care of me and being my advocate and being kind of personable, and you know, the people that I could talk to. So the doctors would do their ward rounds and I kind of couldn't ask any questions, but when the nurses came to talk to me, I always felt that I could have that kind of more personable relationship and talk about how I was feeling and understand what was going to happen next. So that made a big impression on me, I think. So I think probably that's my primary motivation for getting into nursing. Well, I didn't go straight from school, I had a couple of years off, but I came back to the idea eventually.
It's nice, isn't it, that for all the wrong reasons, you were influenced by, you know, people that delivered care to you, and you wanted to obviously replicate that to some extent. And we've heard that on other episodes. Often it's a parent that's inspired you to want to be a nurse, or it's an experience. So that says a lot about this role as a professional and as a vocation and things. So you became a nurse. Where did you specialise? What did you go into in those early days as a qualified nurse?
So my first job was working on a surgical ward. So I was working in Croydon in Southwest London, quite a deprived borough. And I did my nurse training there as well in the kind of old days of kind of vocational training. And I didn't enjoy it much, my training, until my third year, when I worked on this surgical ward. And there was a sister there who was just kind of so different to everyone else that I'd worked with. She's like totally kind of focused on sort of person-centered care, but not just for patients, like for staff as well. So it just felt like a really nice environment, supportive environment to be working in. So I spent a year working there, and then decided that I wanted to work in intensive care, because I quite liked looking after quite sick people, and thought it'd be a good challenge for me. So I then moved to St George's in Tooting, And during my time on ITR, I was with it for about 18 months, I think. It was sort of early days of the HIV pandemic, and looked after a few sort of young men with PCP pneumonia, who some of them survived, some didn't. But the thing that really sort of struck me was A, how young they were, and the second bit was the kind of stigma from staff and family members. So that was kind of quite a important experience for me to kind of witness that. And I decided after that I wanted to work in HIV nursing, which I did for quite a few years after that.
Did you see, I mean, if you think about it, you could, if you went through all the methods of research, right from it, from a case study, right the way through epidemiology, through to trials of medicines and drugs, you could use a case example of HIV and its development from a, you know, this killer disease to what's become very much a chronic condition, a long-term condition, and very livable. Did you get a sense of research because it was so, you know, it's so prominent in that speciality?
Yeah, so I was thinking back today actually around about sort of my early experience of research, and it entirely was the sort of new HIV drugs that were being developed, you know, very rapidly, partly because of kind of community activation and campaigning. That, you know, drugs would develop quite quickly and being tested, and the kind of initial trials kind of flopped. So it's the CONCORD trial, I think it was 1990 or something like that. And it's one drug by itself, wasn't proven to be effective. But understanding the sort of drug resistance from that trial actually led to other medicines being developed. And yes, in the sort of mid 1990s, we started to have really effective drug treatments, and the transformation in patients was, you know, it was just absolutely incredible.
So that was your lens into research, really. You'd seen the impact of research, I suppose, on a patient group, which was a very dramatic change. I mean, that is a real lens into research, isn't it? But what lent itself to you wanting to develop academically? So you, I think you told me you trained, and you call it the traditional training, vocational, and qualified around 1990. I know you did it. You then did a degree, your Bachelor of Science. I know you did an advanced practice master's degree, because we've had these conversations in the past. What made you want to top up the degree, and what made you want to do a master's and advanced practice? Because it takes you back into academia, doesn't it?
Does. I suppose the bit I enjoyed in my vocational training was the kind of academic bits or the educational bits. So as soon as I had an opportunity to get sponsored to do a degree, which I did through doing a community nursing, district nursing course, specialist practitioner course, it was kind of fully funded. So I just kind of jumped at the opportunity really to do that. And then for my master's, I was kind of working as a community matron at that point, and it was looking like that was going to be a kind of prerequisite for the job, to be at least studying at master's level or developing towards a master's. So that to me again made sense to do it. And again, it was fully funded. I was so lucky. Lucky is not the right word. I think fortunate to be working at a time when there was still funding for such programs. So yeah, for both my BSc and master's, it was fully funded and study time. So
So you're, but
it's
you're an
well
advanced nurse
supported.
practitioner then, and you're at the top of your game. And, you know, to do an advanced practice, to work in the role that you worked in, most people that have got an advanced clinical practice qualification, as we call it, an ACP program, whether they're a first contact practitioner or an advanced nurse practitioner, you're at the top of your game. And most people would say, yeah, I've done the bit I didn't want to do, and I've done all the academic bits, and now I can be the practitioner I want to be. I'm prescribing, I'm diagnosing, I'm doing health assessment. You know, you didn't need to then think, I want to go into research, I want to push this further. Why the desire to still progress and work towards a research career?
A couple of reasons, I think. So one is kind of experiencing how the NHS doesn't always evaluate programs particularly well in a particularly robust way. So things often get rolled out, I think, without good evidence because someone's got a hunch that it's going to work, or which isn't necessarily problematic. Or that someone's just kind of wedded to an idea that we should just proceed with a project. So that was part of it. And then along the side of developing as an advanced nurse practitioner and doing my master's, I was also doing some project work. So first of all, looking at a prostate cancer pathway for men prostate cancer, but kind of moving care out of hospital into primary care. So it was kind of 2 year. project funded by Prostate Cancer UK. So it's a good project. And then there was some further project work that I was doing, developing the role of primary care nursing in relation to cancer. And I think it was kind of exposure to the how the NHS was working, how evidence kind of is collected or not, how well programs are being evaluated, that made me really think about wanting to develop my skills in that area.
Yeah, and that probably takes you to about 5 or 6 years ago, I suspect, doesn't it, where you were. And I think that's probably where we first touch base a little bit. I think I probably met you through a bit of a sort of primary care conference that I hosted online with Eleanor, who summarizes this, and we got together as a small group, didn't we, a community of practice, as we called it, around trying to develop research in primary care settings, which is still the hardest place to do it. And we spoke about me trying to support you to put a PhD proposal together, and see if we could apply for good funding to get you a fellowship. And you can perhaps describe the story of what went on with that over a couple of years of us sort of putting it together. We developed the proposal, didn't we? And you can perhaps talk through the experience of that somewhat.
Yeah, I just mentioned though, prior to coming across yourself and Eleanor, I found it very difficult to kind of know where to start in terms of getting into research. So through my clinical practice, there was no one around me that was kind of clinical academic. There's no one in that system that was there that I could obviously go to. So it did take a lot of kind of sort of digging around and investigating to start finding people. And I think it's through kind of social media that I came across Eleanor, and then obviously through Eleanor I met you. So it was a bit of a roundabout road in, but I'm obviously pleased that I found my way in the end.
I
But I
think
think
it.
it just highlights the importance of those kind of structures being there
Yeah.
to, if it's obvious that people, need people to sort of mentor them or support them into these kind of pathways.
It's still very difficult to take people out of primary care settings, which is very much a business with inside an NHS boundary rather than an NHS institution. It's much harder to get people out of primary care and community care settings. You wrote a great proposal and a good couple of applications around the cancer care review. Do you want to sort of identify what your original focus was?
Yeah, so the original focus was looking at I guess doing some research into cancer care reviews, which have been kind of been operating in the NH in primary care in England since 2000. 10, I think. So a good while, but there haven't really been very much research as to kind of what worked for patients and how helpful they actually found it, or what aspects were most helpful. So I was keen to research that as a very sort of practical application of research, really. And we went down a couple of roads, didn't we, to try and get funding. So one was the Schools for Primary Care Research. PhD fellowship. So that was my first application. I was really happy I got shortlisted and got to interview, but I have to say the interview was quite a hard experience. And I think I was probably quite naive at the time. I'd not experienced anything like it. And suddenly go on a call and there was kind of 15 faces there of people kind of, listening and asking questions was I found difficult. And unfortunately wasn't successful. But it was a good experience and it kind of set me up for the next time. So the next time was an NIHR DCAF application, around the same topic, but I'd kind of obviously developed the proposal a lot more, as a much more in-depth application. It probably took about a year probably to get together, I think. So lots of time invested in developing the thinking behind it, the methodology, all the stuff around me and my sort of suitability as a candidate. And again, got shortlisted, got to interview. Again, very tough interview. But I kind of knew what to expect at that time and prepared myself a lot better. And then again, unfortunately, wasn't selected as a to be funded. But had, relatively good feedback, I think, from most of the people on the panel, which kind of inspired me to want to give it another go. But unfortunately, going back to this kind of issue about funding and where people were situated, I was lucky. Aside from my primary care contract, I had a trust. So my brain's gone. Contract, that enabled me to do the decaf application. I think through primary care that would have been impossible. But sort of going back to after I'd not been successful the first time, wanted to give another go, but unfortunately it was a time at NHS in London was making lots of cost cutting savings, and my job was under risk, and I was made redundant last year in about October. That was 2024. So forgetting we're in 2026 now.
But it, but I suppose
Time goes so quickly.
it links closely there, doesn't it? That I know you had a great question. I know you got the methodology right. I was leaning towards supporting you from a primary care perspective, but we'd also built in people in on your team for your methodology. We'd built in people for your cancer care. So you'd got a good team of supervisors around you. We developed your candidacy. You'd got a good CV, a nice proposal, and I'm glad, that you identified there that that on that occasion you weren't successful, but that doesn't mean it's unsuccessful, if that sounds daft. I think what you it's important for people to hear that there was nothing wrong with, there was nothing wrong with your proposals. They got your interview, and you interviewed, and a subjective process means that people are probably then lining you up alongside the money that they've got to give, and alongside the probably the demands of the NHR or the NHS at the time. We might talk about the three shifts now, and aligning things to the three shifts. But everything's got to fit, hasn't it? All the pieces have got to drop into place, and you've got to hope that on that day, everything goes to plan and it aligns. You know that with people like I know that with people like you, had there been more money, you'd have been successful. You weren't unsuccessful because it wasn't a good piece of work, and you hadn't got the right team or the right candidate. It was because there's limited funds, and that smacks of that, doesn't it? That nobody wanted to fund that question, and equally that post was then defunded to some extent. So everything can be against you to some extent, and you had every right then to go, do you know what, stuff this to some extent, because you'd put a hell of a lot of work in. We tried to guide you to how to write a proposal and how to put an application together, and you did a wonderful job. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because you almost the level of competition people need to know at the NHR level, the level of competition is so high, you've almost got to have had a mini research career to almost be a strong candidate. And why would you have had a mini research career at pre-doc or doctoral level? It's very difficult. So I thought you did a wonderful job. We invested a time in you as much as we could, and that's difficult because you've got academics working unfunded to support people to try and be successful, and it's hard to pull everything together and get the time to pull people together. But you did a great piece of work, but it didn't pay off in the end. So tell me what came up for you. How did the stars align? What happened then to make you here today as a PhD student?
That, as you said, that was a kind of major setback for me, and the kind of redundancy on top of it kind of felt like a sort of double whammy, really, in terms of the work I'd been doing that I thought was really important, obviously was all stopping. So I decided to kind of look for other opportunities, and always kind of thought about the possibility of finding a sort of studentship type PhD, but obviously something that kind of aligned with my interests. I think shortly after the redundancy episode, I was looking on find a PhD, and King's College London was there, and I was having a look at what they were offering. And within the palliative care departments, there was some interesting PhDs that are funded by a charity now called Vivenza Foundation, which is a charity to support research in around older people and aging. And the PhD was looking at multimorbidity, there wasn't a great deal of detail around it, but it was looking at multimorbidity and palliative care. I thought that sounds interesting. Obviously worked with lots of older people over the years in primary care and as a community matron. So it kind of ticked lots of boxes for me. So I decided to apply for it, and I got to interview and I was successful. So I was happy and kind of jumped at the opportunity to do it, because it kind of felt like it was wasn't what I wanted to do initially, but it felt like an alternative route into to do my PhD, and it was in the subject that interested me, so it
So
was okay.
what matters, I think, for the listener there is, two attempts and it being unsuccessful in two very strong bids. Getting to interview twice could have really been a kick in the teeth, but I suspect those experiences made you that much stronger at interview for the studentship.
I think so, because I thought, well, if I can get to interview for a really competitive, really, really competitive scheme, I should get to interview for this, and the competition isn't going to be as high. Obviously, I need to do my best and really work hard, but I felt much more kind of optimistic going into that, and felt much better prepared because of the other experiences, and had an idea around what methods I might use, and I think all that is helpful. Interview, if you've actually kind of thought about the project and how you might tackle the question.
And it's difficult. I mean, I can remember vividly, you and I having a weekly catch up for about a month, and me saying, right, present your presentation to me. Right, let me throw a couple of questions at you every week to just get. I was just trying to give you that, right, present to me, because that's what you're going to have to do to your panel. And you do need that, really, don't you? Because you have to almost really get develop the gift of being able to be presenting precisely, quite succinctly. It's difficult, isn't it? And then the questioning comes without you really, you don't know the questions. So the curveballs are often the things that you're kicking yourself, that you get out of an interview for a PhD and go, oh, I should have said that. Oh, I should have said that. And, everybody needs to realize that we all feel that way, don't we, when we've had those interviews?
Yeah, I think so. And as you say, there was an awful lot of preparation, and obviously appreciate all the support I did have to, with those both those applications. But yeah, despite that, kind of felt it's just like one more time. I think I'm
Why is it
convinced I'd
bittersweet? Yeah, the bittersweet thing for me is, the minute you told me you're going for a studentship, I was like, go for it. And then when you were successful, I was like, congratulations. And I'm not saying that through gritted teeth. What you want is you want people to do well, and you want people to sort of flourish where they want to be. I'm gonna say, I can't have the same quote for two episodes, but I think if I'm going to be saying now, okay, Sandra Dyer, advanced nurse practitioner, master's trained, you've been a matron, have you had to take a huge pay cut to then go on and do a studentship for a PhD? I'm going to say Ruth Endicott will have a head in her hands. I've already said that in one episode of this series, but I'm guessing that's the case.
Absolutely. Which isn't easy, but it kind of felt like it was worth it to have the opportunity. So it's a good department, excellent supervisors, and a really good kind of peer support around me as well. So I'm not at all unhappy in how I've kind of how it's all kind of worked out.
It provides you with your research training, you get a PhD. It's like, you devise a PhD proposal and you want to run with it because it's your interest. And I said to the last episode to Faye, I'm going to ask you the same question. So you take a PhD off the shelf and you gain it through a competitive process. What did you think it was, and what actually has it turned out to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure if I knew what it was. I thought it was aligned to my supervisor's kind of previous work, which was very much looking at sort of specialist palliative care and developing an intervention to provide a sort of a short-term period of specialist palliative care for people with multi-morbidity. And the first kind of few weeks, I was kind of thinking through my perception of what I think would work and my experience, and I've kind of flipped it now, so it's actually kind of thinking about what can we do in primary care to support this population of patients, and it feels much more aligned to how I think about things. So it's really changed
It's
as in
evolved
the
for you, hasn't
PhD
it? It's
changed.
evolved for what you can bring the best out of it. Is it so? It's turned into more of what you wanted it to be, rather than, and that's often the case, because what you propose in your first titles probably don't always hold because things shape shift a little bit. But it's about the research training as much as the actual question. And I think people often forget that. You want a PhD that's got enough methods in it to make you research ready to be quite independent once you get your PhD. So, ANP, really qualified nurse, really experienced nurse, at the end of this, and I don't want to project too far. I know congratulations, I know you've just got through your progression with no changes, which is wonderful to hear, because often that's the time where people try to realign you, but clearly you've got it where it needs to be. But what next for you? You get a PhD, or Dr. Sandra Dyer, you're now not working as a nurse clinically. Are you going to go off and be a research associate, or are you going to try and become a clinical academic? What would you want to be afterwards?
Yeah, I'm still thinking about it at the moment. I think some of it will depend on how kind of what happens to the NHS over the next sort of 2 or 3 years. So I do see opportunities in terms of clinical academic roles within primary care that probably weren't there 10 years ago. Whether or not I want to do that or not is what I'll need to think about. So I think that's kind of one mode to consider. I think I'm going to have lots of new skills that I want to test out, and thinking about sort of new projects within the NHS and how they get evaluated. I think the methodology I'm using for my PhD, which is realist evaluation and realist methods, I think are really going to be helpful in terms of evaluating stuff that's going on at the moment and what's likely to happen with the 10-year plan. So I kind of see myself as doing some evaluation definitely in the NHS, and then thinking about broader than that, where I might like to be working. So I kind of feel like the world's my oyster in
Well, it
lots of
should be.
ways.
It should be. You know, you're everything that the NHS England would want you to be, really, apart from working clinically again. But you want that. You know, we had a clinical academic series, but I felt like I was interviewing people who'd got two roles in a week rather than a role that blended into one another. You know, clinical academic role to me should be that you're a clinician who's doing academic things in the clinical setting, not that you should spend 2 weeks at a university or 2 days at university and 3 days at a hospital. You want really to be researching your own patient group and your own dilemmas and areas of uncertainty and those sorts of things. And I don't think there's a lot of role models in primary care for people at the moment. You know, I've with you, you know, with your support, I've been trying to sort of champion primary care for research through the School for Primary Care Research. You did very well. I think you won a prize at the School for Primary Care Research Conference with your work.
Thank you.
I think it's difficult. So you've got a bit of a uphill battle again if you want to go back into the clinical world from a primary care perspective, haven't you? Have you thought about that challenge?
Yeah, I have. So I agree with you. I don't think I'd want to do two jobs. As in, I'm often had two jobs in my career, but if I was going to go back into clinical work, I'd want it to be a clinical academic role. And at the moment, they don't exist in primary care. Whether or not that will change, I don't know. But what I would want to do is to become some support others who are trying to achieve that. And thinking back to my sort of difficulty initially in terms of finding my way into research, I'd like to support others to do that and make those transitions easier and the road a bit clearer to navigate. So that's definitely an ambition of mine, is to try and support that route for others. I don't know what that looks like yet, but I'm thinking on it. And then the other thing for me is I'm very interested in kind of social justice and sort of geopolitics. So thinking about NGOs and other organisations that might want researchers. So that's what I said about the world's my oyster. I kind of feel like I want to think very broadly about what next, that kind of lies with my values and interests. So we'll see. Yeah,
I
but
mean, and
it's
it's
great
early
to have that
days.
choice.
What have you got? What, just under 18 months left of the PhD?
Probably just under
About
2 years.
just under 2 years.
So there's still plenty of time, I think.
And you know, in these early days, I mean, to be able to move it to where you want it to be, you know, and justify that at a progression point is quite the skill. Because in the stage that you're at, often you're quite led, and in the second half of the PhD, you're leading your supervisors down the direction you want to go. So it feels like you're ahead of the game with that a little bit, I think. But I suppose my thought with the PhD is if you are now talking to the audience of listeners and they are clinicians of any way, shape, or form that are thinking, well, actually, I'm quite senior clinically, and do I do a PhD? What's your advice? What's your guidance?
I think it depends where you want to go and what you want to do. And obviously for each person that's different. Obviously it's a big commitment in terms of time. So I think it does depend on kind of where you are in terms of other life commitments as to whether it's suitable or not. But if you do get a chance, if there is an opportunity to do that and it interests you, then I say go for it. My first year has not been without challenge, but it's been an amazing experience. I still think, there's still obviously lots more for me to learn. It's good to have a challenge, and I definitely feel like I'm up for it.
So no regrets.
No regrets at all.
Yeah.
No.
And that's it's all you can, that's all you can hope to hear, isn't it, from people that are now embedded in this. And you've given a lot when you've been in the clinical role. You've certainly given a lot, and you've had to lose a little bit in order to sort of to do the PhD. But it should give you the platform that you're looking for to go on and like say be what you want to be. And I think you're a real advocate for this. And if the world transpires to the point that it gets you back into primary care, then it gives people like me a role model to signpost people to. That's the important thing for me. You working with me, Sandra Dyer, to try and get on a PhD, I didn't really have anybody I could signpost you to. I felt like I was a voice for primary care rather than a voice of primary care. And it's so difficult that you haven't got the trailblazers, and you're becoming one. That's where you're heading to, and it's really lovely to see. So I suppose my final question to you really is, if I was coming, so if I'm let's say I'm repeating this series in 5 years' time, what would you have hoped to achieve? Where would you hope to be? You can't say retired.
No, definitely not retired. That's a good question. I think there's lots of variables that I can't predict. But obviously, I've obviously expect to finish my PhD. And then feeling like I'm doing something very useful with the skills that I've done. So whether that's evaluating programs in the NHS, supporting other nurses to get into research, or developing kind of pathways for more less experienced nurses, all that would be kind of feel like a very useful use of my skills and knowledge. So I don't know, I'm definitely keeping an open mind as to what that looks like. But yeah, a job that ticked those boxes and enabled me to do some travel and work remotely, all those things together would make me a happy person, I
When you
think.
find this job, I might compete for you with you for it. This traveling job where you can do these sorts of things, sounds attractive. But you're more than capable of doing it, Sandra. If I was, if me and my co-colleagues that worked with you were one rung on the learning ladder to get you where you are, then we're really proud to have been a part of it. And as a series, and as people listen, we'll be following your success. And initially it will be looking for your output and the things that you are putting out there, and seeing how your work sort of gets out there from an impact perspective. And so all I'll say is, Sandra Dyer, lovely to speak to you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been good to have a chat.
Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast, where Eleanor and I are in a position again to summarize the episode. And Eleanor, this time Sandra Dyer, somebody that we both met several years ago and have sort of watched her career with great interest, really.
So delighted that Sandra is doing her PhD now. I know it's not been easy, but what an inspiring story. I thought right from the start when she started telling you about what inspired her to become a nurse. It's not certainly not been an easy experience, has it? Right from when she had her
No.
car accident, but that was obviously quite a pivotal point in her life when she sort of was observing, the roles of nurses that were looking after her, and that inspired her to develop a nursing career. But her journey hasn't been particularly easy, has it, to get to the point of doing a PhD? But I guess, in some ways, whose is? Yeah, maybe there are some people where it has been perhaps, I don't know, is easier the right word? Maybe the doors have opened a bit more easily. But I think what she's showed is so much grit and determination and that perseverance that you do need to do the PhD anyway. And there's a lot of failure, isn't there, that we don't talk about, that I think is good to talk about and put out there in the open. We've all failed and we've all had to probably apply for, either fellowships or opportunities, certainly on more than one occasion. And I think it's probably good to have those open discussions, isn't it? But yeah, it's certainly been in tough for her, I think, as well as being made redundant, which she mentioned. And but hopefully, now she's doing her PhD. That's a positive thing, and giving her the opportunity to apply all those things she was talking about, how she felt like, evidence programs aren't always evaluated particularly well in the NHS, and so now she has actually got the opportunity to develop her skills to be able to do that research, to evaluate programs, and then hopefully utilize any new skills like she mentioned for any future steps she might take.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've had a lot of credit, particularly on this episode, and for anybody listening and listens to episode 5, which is already recorded, we've had a little bit of credit on that as well, because I think we've, inadvertently pulled a few people together and created a few sort of links between people, and just got people in a position where they felt like they've got somebody else in their situation, and they've had some support. So, Sandra was part of an early community of practice that you started, really, and I came on board with. And I think we were very quick to say, this is much harder in primary care. It's a much steeper hill to climb, and she's demonstrated that. I think what jumped, I mean, it's always difficult when people start to talk about, what inspired them to be a nurse, because you could delve deeper into things like that, and then the jobs that led to research. But I try to stick to task and not pull out too much of the clinical stuff, and link to the research side, or drive towards the research subject matter. But with Sandra, it always makes me think, because when I've done a lot of my research teaching over the years as a lecturer and senior lecturer and reader now, up until COVID, I always used HIV as the prime example of the development of research, and how it went from a single case study, to the epidemiology, the distribution of the disease, and our understanding of it, from correlation to causation to cure. It was the prime example of how to discuss the development of research methods. And I think the minute she said that, I just jumped to, you must have felt like you were at the pinnacle of research with HIV. So for her to discuss those, RCTs in 1990, which would have been a language not in the nursing sphere, and the things that she was talking about. So that leapt out at me at first. And I think the other thing with Sandra, like a number of people that we've spoken to in already in this PhD series, is these are very established people, and they've probably got a little bit more autonomy sometimes than more junior staff, your band fives, your band sixes, to try and step into a research role. But they're showing that even at the top of the game clinically, it's so hard to get on what I consider the fully funding ladder. So we're back to where we were a little bit with previous episodes of scholarships again, and nurses, rightly or wrongly, being somewhat, grateful of a stipend and a funded education, rather than, being able to fully commit to what would be a salaried PhD. So it disappoints me a little bit, because you and I met with Sandra very early, around 2020, 2021, and then I sort of supported Sandra with a number of other people to get to those two interviews that she got to, and she just couldn't get over the line. And I feel disappointed that she isn't getting what she deserves. So I'm very grateful that she's got that opportunity where she is to do what she's due to do the PhD. But somebody who's been a matron and advanced nurse practitioner right at the top of the game to have to step down into a studentship still, fills me with disappointment.
And actually, when I was listening to this podcast again, I listened to it a couple of times actually because I found Sandra's story really interesting. I was reflecting on those difficulties, of making that decision, especially when you have so much experience like Sandra does, and to be made redundant. As well, it doesn't seem quite fair, does it, to have all of that experience and not be completely supported to be able to continue, clinically if you want to, and to be able to undertake, a PhD, and navigating that, it's just so difficult. I also underestimated maybe how important that support system is as well. I didn't. Because it has been mentioned, hasn't it, about the community of practice and how important it is to find other peers trying to navigate the same, clinical academic or academic pathway. But I did think to myself, this isn't about the individuals. This is about the structural issues that are perhaps missing, particularly for nurses and allied health professionals. And like you say, almost like a compounded pressure if you work in, or compounded factor if you work in primary and the community, because there's even less chance of having those opportunities. Because if you're working in a GP practice, it's very much down to the practice, isn't it, as to whether or not they can allow you to have that time to, even if it's funded or not funded, it's a case of can we release you, isn't it, to be able to do that. And
There's
that
no,
seems
there's
really
nothing in it.
harsh,
There's nothing in it
really
for primary
harsh.
care. They cannot see the value of releasing, a clinician. If a medic is released from general practice to be a clinical academic, it's because they're a partner or they're a salary GP and they've agreed that in the contract. It doesn't happen the same with nursing. And Sandra has had to overcome all sorts of things. The as an ACP, so an advanced clinical practitioner, she had issues with the where she'd received that award. She didn't have what was called the digital badge, which made her less employable. She was already at the top of a game, and then it shows you how you very much have to align your research, irrespective of what level it's at. You have to align it to where the interest is, where the current attention is. So, if I'm supporting anybody with a grant now, if I'm writing one myself, I'm thinking about the three shifts, I'm thinking about the 10-year plan as well as everything else. And what jumped out to me a little bit was when she said, the cancer care, she didn't get the PhD twice. And I knew it was a good application. I'd worked with her with three other potential supervisors, and I'd worked with her probably three Fridays in a row practicing her presentation. She'd come online, we'd practice a presentation, and she'd got it. It was very tight, it was to the timing, and I knew it was a good PhD. But the fact that it didn't tick the boxes for the funder makes me just think it just wasn't the right topic at the right time. And the fact that she then says the funding for the post then disappears, it shows it's not where the money's been thrown at the time. So she was the right person with the right study at the wrong time.
And those are the three factors, aren't there, that you do have to think about. There is a fair bit of strategy, isn't there, that you have to consider to get those fully funded positions, which are far and few between, and like you say, even further and few between in primary and community settings. I would like to think that, moving forwards with the shifts that are hopefully occurring with a more focus on the community, that there'll be more opportunities for research in those areas. But of course, for nurses and allied health professionals in those areas, they need the support, which I know the NIHR are developing more of, aren't they? Particularly focusing on undergraduate level now, how to embed research and to build that confidence and that understanding about health and care research more at that stage of somebody's career. Hopefully, that will follow on with then funding opportunities as well. But it is incredibly difficult and a massive sacrifice, isn't it, when you have to go to, when you've had a successful career as a clinician, to then making the decision to go on to a stipend or, just focusing on your PhD when maybe you still wanted to do a bit of clinical work. I don't know. It's a personal decision, isn't it? But,
Well, it just shows the dedication, really. I know the work she put in. I know that she went out of her way to try and do these things and worked on them in her own time, and it didn't pay off. And I'm not slapping your hand for saying she failed, using that term, the failures. I don't think they're failures. I think sometimes failure is different than being unsuccessful, because failure means nothing comes from it. But sometimes when you're unsuccessful with research, you take from it what you can. You take from it the fact that you've had a couple of online interviews to be able to get a grant. You've figured out how to write a grant and how to space it out. You've figured out the time that you need. You take something from being unsuccessful. You have to. And she's been able to do that. And nobody's twisted her arm to do a stipended PhD. She's taken a PhD that she thought would fit her interest, and it gets her the research training. It gets her, the funding that's required from the university. The locality is right for her, and she has, she hasn't mapped it out yet, but she's only just got through progression. But she has postdoc plans, so we have to sort of really sort of wish her well and hope that somebody bites her hand off at the end of it to say, come and be a clinical academic, in the area and with the skill set that you've got postdoctorally.
Absolutely. And maybe there is something to, maybe I've become a little bit hardened, maybe too much, you know, having worked in academia a little bit, you get a little bit more comfortable perhaps with being unsuccessful or, you know, with failing. But maybe that as well. I do, my own sort of view is that there is more that we can do in nursing and midwifery and the allied health professionals to kind of be a bit more competitive, because academia is competitive, isn't it? When you think, you know, if you think about it a bit like athletics, that's kind of sometimes how I think about it. You know, you might win some and you might lose some. It's a bit like that with grants as well, isn't it? And it's so there's almost like a bit of a mentality you kind of have, or a mindset you have to build, that needs nurturing from early on, really, so that you're prepared for that, and you have to keep going. Whereas, you know, in medicine, you know, medical students are doing research projects at an early stage. They're publishing early, they're submitting abstracts, they're doing conferences at very early stages. Not to say that nursing students don't, but I think it probably has historically been,
Yeah, it's a
you know,
bigger
the
part.
expectation in medicine, hasn't it? So
It's a bigger part. There are more funders. There's more expectations on medics. You know, they are considered a higher caliber, and you know, so I'm not saying it's easier to get funding for research as a medic, but with the expectation being there, there probably are more open doors. But you know, to balance that out, I think we have to be conscious that in our time being involved in research, there's probably never been a better time than now. If we
yeah.
look at the NIHR infrastructure, from insights programs to
Exactly. Yeah.
internships, to
Yeah.
masters, to pre-doctorates, to pre-application awards, it's there now. We're seen as an underrepresented discipline. There's a lot there at all the different levels. And then from a postdoc perspective, we have research for patient benefit targeting just nurses and midwives this year again. And we have the three schools approach of things like the NIHR, primary care research, and you know, those sorts of things. So there's lots out there. I think what we've got to get right is the marketing, the language. We've got to use people like myself as a senior research leader, and the people that have, you know, the original sort of the original cohorts of senior research leaders and the future cohorts of developing research leaders, being the people that people can go to get an understanding of what the process is, because nobody gives you that launch pad. You have to almost go and seek it out. And I think senior research leaders have a duty there to make sure that they are
Yeah.
imparting the knowledge that people don't have. Because the other thing is you've got to do is you've got to convince the employers that this is the right move for their staff, because you are lowering your opportunities for recruitment and retention if you don't provide opportunities for staff. And primary care is
Exactly.
in a
Yeah.
recruitment and retention crisis at the minute.
Yeah.
And I'm not blaming that on a lack of research opportunities, but it's one string to that bow.
Yeah. I completely agree, and the it is a great career opportunity, but the career progression and the opportunities also need to be there, don't they? If it becomes another sort of avenue that you can go down, which is the misalignment at the minute, isn't it? But hopefully we'll see that continuing to progress.
So we know Sandra, we wish her well. We know she'll do well. She's clearly flown through progression, no changes, which is
Yes, she
quite
did.
unbelievable. It shows it's right
Yeah, very
what she's
impressive.
doing. We'll keep an eye on her progress, and you know, and we'll report on that in the future at some point. But yeah, Sandra's certainly put the hard yards in and deserves everything that she gets out of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So thanks for your time, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Bye bye.